Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Hello.
Welcome to day two of Women in Comics 2007. I'm Leanna Kate, co-host of Edinburgh's Night Party, City TV, 11:35 Fridays. And it is my pleasure and privilege today to introduce the Vertigo Sneak Peek panel. And you guys got way more than you were hoping for. You're lucky. Because not only is DC Vertigo editor Shelley Bond here, but Cecil Castellucci is here as well, accomplished comic book creator and writer, and there will be a special surprise guest dropping in on the panel. So enjoy, ask lots of questions, be proactive, and take it away, ladies.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. I'm Shelley Bond, and I'm really happy to be here to talk about what's hot and cool and new coming up with the Vertigo line. And also, I want to introduce the Minx line to those of you who might not have attended the panel yesterday. So I think we'll start with Minx first. And fortunately, to my right, I have the fabulous Cecil Castellucci, who is the writer of my very first Minx title, The Plain Janes. For those of you who don't know, Minx is the very first young adult graphic novel line ever, and I'm super proud of it. We launched on May 16th with The Plain Janes, and since I have Cecil here, I would love for her just to give you a brief summary of what the book is all about.
Hi. I'm super happy to be on Minx, and Plain Janes is a story about a girl who is in a terrorist attack, and her parents freak out, and they move her to the suburbs. They move to the suburbs, and Jane, her name is Jane, she decides to change her life, and she found a sketchbook at the scene of the, you know, attack, and it said art saves on it, and so she feels that this is the way that her life is going to be saved. And so when she gets to the lunchroom at high school, she says no to the popular girls and goes straight to the reject table, and there sits three other girls named Jane, and they start a secret art girl gang in order to save the world, but really to save themselves. That's it.
Okay, can we talk about the art?
Oh, please.
Does anyone know Jim Rugg's work? Can I see a show of hands? Any Jim Rugg fans? You guys familiar with Street Angel? Jim is a tremendously talented cartoonist. And I have to tell you that as an editor, there is nothing more rewarding than hooking up a writer and an artist to create the magic on the page, and there's some serious magic here. Cecil, tell us a little bit about how it was to work with Jim for the first time.
Well, working with Jim was awesome because, you know, this is my first comic book. I write novels, which have a lot of words and no pictures. And so it was really great because he really helped me to learn how to pace. And, you know, he made me feel brave enough to sort of remove a lot of words so that the images could just sort of rest on the page and, you know, do a lot of the storytelling, which is obviously what happens in graphic novels and comic books. And so it was really exciting to work with someone who's just so enormously talented and fabulous, like Jim Rugg. I love Jim Rugg.
The second book in the Minx line is called Regifters, and it's written by Mike Carey, who some of you might know from Lucifer and Hellblazer, and it's illustrated by Sunny Liu and Mark Hempel. And this is the same team that did a book that Vertigo put out a few years ago called My Faith in Frankie. Did anyone read My Faith in Frankie? Well, that was one of the books that gave me the idea for the Minx line. And this is their second collaboration together as a team. And this book basically is about a girl named Jen Dixsong, or Dixie, as she's known to her friends. She's Korean-American, dirt poor, and living on the edge of LA's Koreatown. Her only outlet is the martial art Hapkido, until she falls for a fellow Hapkido stroke surfer boy named Adam, and it puts her totally off her game. Basically, she learns that in love and in martial arts, what goes around comes around. So this is a book that's coming out June 13th, so definitely look for it later this month. Clubbing is our third title by indie favorites Andy Watson and Josh Howard. Any Andy Watson or Josh Howard fans in the audience? Okay, that's okay. Hopefully you will be fans after you pick up Clubbing. This book is about a girl named Lottie, who gets caught with a fake ID at an extravagant West End nightclub. And she's basically the type of girl who's known for her platform shoes and her unbridled passion for classic lit. And when she gets caught with the fake ID, she's sentenced to spend the summer at her grandparents' stuffy country club, which is located in the Lake District. And she basically narrowly escapes romance and ends up solving a murder mystery on the 19th hole of her grandparents' golf course. So definitely look out for that in mid-July of this year. I hope you all don't mind. I did come prepared with a slideshow, and sometimes it seems kind of stiff when you're reading it, but I really want the information to come across clearly, so I hope you will cut me a little slack if I do come across like I'm just reading. And at the end of the presentation, Cecil and I will do a little Q&A, and then we'll be happy to take your questions to make it a little bit more interactive. This book is called The Vinyl Underground, and I'm super excited about it. We announced it last month at the Bristol Convention, and it's a book that has been in the works for quite a few years. It's written by Cy Spencer, who is a wonderful writer who works for British television. He's written EastEnders for many years, and he did a book for me a few years ago called Books of Magic, Life During Wartime. This is his first big breakout book, and it is just beyond cool. It's about a group of unlikely occult detectives who solve crimes in London, and it's headed by a D-list celebrity named Morrison Sterling, who at the start of the series just gets out of prison and really wants to turn his life around, so he becomes sort of like a secret informant to the cops. And it's about his ex-girlfriend and his current girlfriend and another ex-con he met, and how they form this unlikely team of sort of like CSI investigators and help the cops bring down some of the nasties in modern London. It's incredibly cool. It's penciled by Simon Gain, who is probably new to mainstream comics readers. He's done a bit of work for Slave Labor, but he's incredible. And he's being inked by Toronto native Cameron Stewart, who is just bringing some major magic to this book. I am totally, like, blown away with what Cameron has brought. Is anyone familiar with Cameron's work from The Other Side or Sea Guy? He's brought so much rock and roll to this comic, and I cannot wait for you guys to see it. It's in stores in October. And we feature covers by Sean Phillips, who hasn't done Vertigo work for a while, and he's really, like, rocking it with the lineup of covers for this series. Any Hellblazer fans in the audience? Excellent. I don't know about you guys, but I was knocked out by Andy Diggle's Hellblazer. You guys liking it? What struck me is just that the humor's back, and it reminded me a lot of what turned me on to Hellblazer when Jamie Delano first wrote it. I felt like there was just that really, like, hardcore, you know, down and out John Constantine, and I felt that the story was so accessible. I'm loving it. Basically, this is the cover for issue 234, and in South London's Hunger Hill housing estate, which has long been a breeding ground for violence, crime, and drug abuse. In this issue, the cycle of misery takes a turn for the supernatural as John Constantine discovers there's something much worse going on. Hellblazer is written by Andy Diggle with art by Leonardo Manco and covers by the fabulous Lee Bermejo, who I think is also doing some awesome work on these covers. This issue is quite special because we will be featuring a free preview of another upcoming book called The Unmen, so definitely check it out. I'll tell you a little bit more about The Unmen later in the slideshow. Why The Last Man? Any fans? Excellent. I know, I'm so bummed it's ending. I'm not the only one, right? Oh my god. Well, the end is near, as they're telling me in my script, for Why The Last Man. But in issue 57, and this is the cover, which reaches stores in July, it's part 3 of the 5-part story Whys and Wherefores, written by Brian K. Vaughan with art by Pia Guerra and a cover by Massimo Canerval. The group heads towards its conclusion on the streets of Paris. And I know that Brian has some pretty major surprises in store for the last couple of issues, and it's going to be well worth the wait. But I think we're all going to be, like, really, like, totally missing it when it's over. Any Fables fans?
Yes.
How about those Eisner nods this year?
Yes.
Loving it. Yeah, this book is so much fun to work on. I mean, I think Bill Willingham is such a genius, and he continues to amaze me with each and every script. You know, when someone's writing a series and it's coming like up on its fifth year, you think, well, is it going to sag? Is it going to get a little boring? Never. The guy continues to knock me out on a monthly basis, and somehow he manages to just kind of break new ground with each and every storyline. In issue 63, and this is the cover, by James Jean, the fabulous James Genius, as I call him. The Good Prince storyline continues, and basically, as plans to destroy the Imperial homeworld move forward, more and more fables return to their homeland. Now, this storyline is really quite unique because we sort of connect up with our sister series, Jack of Fables. So there's going to be a special event this summer where our two books actually sync up in time. So you'll learn a lot of interesting secrets from both Jack of Fables and For Fables. If you continue reading both books, the fable storyline this summer is called The Bad Prince. So there's a connection that's deeper than the titles. So definitely keep your eyes peeled. Any Crossing Midnight readers? Excellent. Also a Mike Carey title. Beautiful cover by J.H. Williams III. This particular issue is a guest art issue, and Mike Carey is joined by artist Eric Gwynn, who recently drew the Sandman Mystery Theater miniseries. It's issue 10, and having arrived in Tokyo, Kai falls in with the Anjokosai, underage girls who date middle-aged men for money. In Japan, it's completely legal and not unusual, but a supernatural slasher is voicing disapproval in a very bloody way. This issue's in stores in August. Testament. In Testament 21, written by Douglas Rushkoff and illustrated by Liam Sharp, Jake is now leader of the temple, and the resistance is ready to escape from their bondage. But the resistance's modern-day Moses won't be who Jake expects. Don't miss out on this intriguing issue in stores in August. The Exterminators. Any fans in the audience? This issue is the cover to issue 20, and the cover is by some slacker artist named Philip Bond, who may or may not be related to me. But how cool is that? Artist Derek Robertson jumps on board for this issue and does the guest art of on the interiors, written by Simon Oliver, and it's in store in August. In this issue, the Bugbee crew locks and loads for an apocalyptic showdown with the invading Mayan Hizar army. I always love to tell people the story about the Exterminators. When it was first pitched to Vertigo, their writer came up with the perfect log line, which was 6 feet under with bugs. I thought that was just genius and really intrigued us. And I think it's definitely like a favorite of the Vertigo staff. We just think it's so cool. And like, what could be bad? Like lots of bugs on covers and inside a comic. How cool. Northlanders. This is the new series coming out by Brian Wood. It will be in stores this December. I think I talked to quite a few Brian Wood fans this weekend. A lot of DMZ fans in the audience as well. Very cool. DMZ writer Brian Wood presents an exciting look at the heyday of the Vikings in Northlanders, which is an ongoing series with art by, I hope I get his name right, David Gianfelice, and covers by Massimo Carnival from Why the Last Man fame. The first story in Northlanders is called Sven the Returned, begins over 1,000 years ago, when England was under Viking control, as a 20-something warrior prince returns to his hometown to engage in a power struggle with his brutal, corrupt uncle. Should be really cool stuff. Again, in store in December. And DMZ, how about those rocking covers? Brian Wood is such a great graphic designer, and I think this is one of the strongest covers for the series, and there have been tons, but this one I think is just really, really cool. It's for issue 22, and it starts the five-part Friendly Fire. Oh, I'm sorry, it ends the five-part Friendly Fire storyline, coming out in August. With the verdict on day 204 massacre hitting the headlines, the eyes of the world are once again on the DMZ, fearing the worst. And just as tensions reach a boiling point, the military give the people of Manhattan a gift, the soldier responsible for it all. So again, look for that in stores in August. Army at Love, the new Rick Veitch book. Anybody enjoying that one? Cool. So in this particular issue, which is number 6, coming out in August, Rick Veitch uses irony and moral ambiguity to paint the big picture of what war might be like not many years from now. The series is underway to strong reviews, and in August's number 6 issue, Lohman shows up on Switzer's doorstep in Afghanistan, intent on locating his compatriot's clinging wife, which should be interesting. Faker. Anyone get the early buzz on Faker? Okay, well, let me be the first to tell you, this book is really intense. I'm the editor, obviously, and I basically, the genesis of the book happened a number of years ago when I was talking to Mike Carey about how I was so tired of people being fake. And we went through a whole conversation of just coming up with all the different ways that just people are so plastic in the world. And at the end of our conversation, I just said, God, you have to write a book called Faker. So sometimes ideas for books are as simple as that. They come out of a conversation, and there's nothing I like more than actually like talking about something that is really annoying or aggravating to me, and then having a writer grab it and then just really let loose on the page. And that's what happened here. It's a 6-issue psycho horror story, and it's set in the dead of winter in Minnesota in the freezing cold, and it's second semester for a group of freshmen who come back from their winter break, and they party hard first night back, party like there's no tomorrow, and the next day they wake up and there are 5 of them. And what's really weird is that nobody knows who their friend Nick is. Like, he's their best friend. They've known him since September, but he's not on the computer's mainframe, and they're starting to wonder, like, what's up? Like, he seems real, but maybe he isn't. So it's this really, like, weird story about just how people aren't always exactly what you think they are in more ways than one. The art is by Jock, who's doing an amazing job. You might know Jock from The Losers. And this book comes out in July, so definitely look out for it. The Unmen. This was the new ongoing monthly that I alluded to earlier. Again, a free sneak preview in Hellblazer 234. Does anyone remember The Unmen from Swamp Thing? Cool. Well, the classic original Swamp Thing series will echo through Vertigo again this August. With this series, it's written by John Whalen, who is new to comics, but he's an established novelist. And it's illustrated by Mike Hawthorne, with covers by Tomer Hanukkah. Created by the twisted experiments of Anton Arcane, the Unmen are a cadre of grotesqueries, living in secret in the Nevada desert, until investigator Simon Kilcrop, himself deemed a freak by society, discovers their existence. So it should be really interesting. Apparently this is a character that is a brain and a hands, which, you know, just from the looks of it is like really weird, creepy. I'm psyched to check it out. American Virgin. The Around the World story continues in issue 18, which is written by Steve Siegel with art by Becky Cloonan and the fabulous Jim Rugg, who, as we talked about, is the illustrator of The Plain Janes. This cover is by Celia Cal, who is an amazing painter. And in this issue, Adam Chamberlain is having trouble figuring out what to do with the opposite sex. So how will a third sex fit into the picture? He may find out when he reaches India. In stores in August. Silverfish. Any David Lapham fans out there? Okay, this book is textbook Lapham. If you like Stray Bullets even a little bit, this is like Stray Bullets on Red Bull. It is awesome. It's basically John Hughes meets Hitchcock. It's about a teenager named Mia who has a stepmom who she believes to be is a gold digger. She can't stand her. She really thinks that she's up to something. So when the stepmother and her dad go away for the weekend, she invites her friends over and they steal her stepmother's address book and they make that one fateful call to a person from her stepmother's past. Who's like a psychotic killer who believes he's possessed by a demonic silverfish. And they make the mistake of crank calling him. So he speeds up the East Coast from North Carolina, intent to find out who they are and seek revenge. And it's this crazy, suspenseful story that will really leave you breathless by the very end. I highly recommend it. It's due in stores June 27th, and I'm just thrilled to have been able to edit it with David. He is such a master of suspense, and his art in this book is so solid and so frenetic. I used to joke with him that when I would get the inks in, I was convinced somebody was holding a gun to his head to like finish the pages because they were that intense. And the pace is so frenetic that it really does leave you, like, absolutely shaking. So check it out at the end of the month. Sentences is also an original graphic novel that we're putting out this year that is just a tremendous piece of work. New York's hip-hop culture is the setting for the book, which is out in September. And it's written by MC rapper Percy Carey, who's also known as MF Grimm, and illustrated by Ronald Wimberly, who is a wonderful up-and-coming artist who's done a bit of work for us on Lucifer and has an issue of Dead Man coming out this summer. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the world and history of the underground hip-hop scene. Sentences shows the dark, violent truth behind the flashy, glamorized images of hip-hop that we've seen in the movies and on TV. So definitely look out for this book in September. This book is also black and white, as well as Silverfish. They are both the square-bound format books we've been doing over the years, like Sloth and the originals by Dave Gibbons. It's a format that we really consider to be special, that we reserve for our auteurs and people that have a really passionate story that demands black and white. So we're really proud of this book and we hope you enjoy it and look out for it this fall. My special guest has arrived, the fabulous editor Joan Hilty, who has been editing comic books for years for the DC Universe, is working with Vertigo. Yet again, she started with Vertigo, and she wanted to come back, so she wrote us a check, and here she is.
Nice.
And she's working on a wonderful project called Cairo, which is also an original graphic novel in the same square-bound black and white format that I just mentioned. And Joan was nice enough to come here and actually give you first-hand info on this fantastic project.
And while I would never normally call to attention, is this on?
No.
No?
Okay. And while I would never normally call to attention the fact that anyone was reading from the script, I'm just going to steal this.
Yeah, it wasn't obvious.
About it wasn't, I'm not a morning person.
It wasn't obvious that I was reading from a script now, was it? Thank you, Jen.
So I'll tell you the official skinny, and I'll talk just a little bit more about it. This is a original graphic novel by journalist G. Willow Wilson, who has written for the Atlantic Monthly and Cairo Magazine. and it's illustrated by M.K. Perker, who's a tremendously prolific Turkish artist who is a contributor to the New York Times, the New Yorker, and has actually recently done some work for Shelley and Fables. And it's basically his North American comics debut. It's set in the bustling metropolis of Cairo, the largest city in the Middle East and Africa, and it is basically a magic realist fable that interweaves the lives of a drug runner, a down-on-his-luck journalist, an American expatriate, an Israeli soldier who has been wounded at the border and is trying to survive inside the Egyptian borders, a vengeful magician, genie who has just escaped from the clutches of the vengeful magician, and all their fates, a young Lebanese-American kid passing through on a very dangerous mission to Beirut, and one stolen hookah, a water pipe, brings them all together. And it's just a wonderful sort of fast-paced thriller that takes place both in modern Cairo and in a sort of magical underworld below Cairo that everyone discovers called the Under Nile. Willow is a tremendously talented new writer. She was actually called to my attention by Keith Giffen, and I owe it big to both Keith and Karen for calling her to my attention and for taking a chance on her with this. She's actually also going to be writing a one-shot. If any of you are Outsiders readers, there's a fifth-week event coming out in August called Five of a Kind, and Willow is also the author of the Metamorpho and Aquaman one-shot. So I'm really looking forward to this, and this will be, this Cairo in particular will be out in November.
Great. Thank you so much, Joan. Looks amazing. I've actually had the chance to flip through the entire book, and what I found so awesome about M.K. Perker's work is that it was so robust. It it's just really intense, and I think his gray wash is just gives it the final touch.
It's beautiful stuff. They were a great combination, and he also just a workhorse. You know, he finished a whole graphic novel in under a year. He was just amazing. It was like one of my only on-time projects. It's 156 pages.
Nice. So. Excellent.
Anyway.
And that concludes the slideshow portion of our presentation. Hope you enjoyed it. At this point, we would be happy to take some questions from the audience. Hi, over there.
With the success of Fables, is there any hope that we will see more stories from the Bill Willingham, like Coventry and Opposition Player? Because I really enjoyed those, and it was so disappointing to read the three issues of Coventry and find out that it was important.
Tell me about it. Oh my God. Every couple of months. Yeah, I'll restate the question. Will there be any more Bill Willingham projects, such as Coventry or Proposition Player? Bill wrote some wonderful miniseries in the 90s. One of them that was not affiliated with Vertigo was called Coventry, which got my attention way back in the early 90s. And I was just thrilled to see Bill in comics again. And that sort of made me realize, God, I have to find him. God, he has to do work for Vertigo. And I've been asking him for years if he's going to ever finish it or if he would bring it to Vertigo. And he always says to me, I'll let you know some other time. And that line has been fed to me for like 8 years. So I hope he finishes it. I know, you know, he's going to get back to it one day, not sure when. As far as other minis, Bill is so prolific and has so many stories. He still does some work for the DC Universe, and we've really tried to schedule a special event for Fables every year. You know, this past year we had the amazing original graphic novel, 1001 Nights of Snowfall, which I'm proud to say is nominated for an Eisner this year. So that was this past year's special book, and we have something super special lined up for next year as well. So I think you'll definitely see more work from Bill. Not sure about specifically what it would be, but he definitely has a lot of tricks up his sleeve, and there will be an announcement at San Diego about something else he's involved with, but it's not going to be Coventry.
Well, I just like his writing. I really like Proposition Player, which
it's a great book.
It was short, but it,
yeah.
At least he managed to conclude it.
Yes.
Coventry just
I know. Well,
there's a whole class of guys, Mark Agrippa, who I've worked with for years. I always ask him when he's ever going to come back. And what was it called? The Lost Boys, his teenage vampire runaway series, which he never finished all those years ago. So there's just a whole gaggle of guys you should just lock in a room.
And exactly.
Get them to finish.
Yeah.
Get them to conclude.
It could take Bill.
Hi, your question?
I read a quote by Hugh Gifford recently saying that Vertigo would only let DC use Animal Man in the 52 series if Grant Morrison was writing the character. And I was actually just curious as to how separate DC and Vertigo are now with companies that would be the case that one would have to let one do the other. I mean, I just kind of always assumed Vertigo is a branch of DC and not necessarily the one that's now controlling characters that were perhaps part of the DC universe vision.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. Just to recap, it was asked how Vertigo and DC share characters, basically. He was saying that he read a quote that Keith Giffen said that Vertigo would only let the DC Universe work with Animal Man if Grant Morrison would write it again. I haven't read that quote, but I will tell you that in the early days of Vertigo, when we were doing more DC-owned characters, we were definitely a little bit more territorial, I think, about which books had sort of occult characters that might be more likely to show up in a Vertigo world versus some of the caped crusaders, for lack of a better term, who might not really play well, so to speak, in the Vertigo arena.
Yeah, it's really a matter, I think, of who's, you know, what characters we think are more popular with a particular audience at any given time. There's always a two-way street of communication between DCU and Vertigo, for instance, especially regarding any characters that have been in both universes. Shadow Pact, for instance, the mystical series that's out from that runs in the DC Universe now, I think there was some discussion at the start with Vertigo about what characters, you know, would be good for DCU readers and what characters you guys would rather keep with Vertigo for a while, depending on what was in development. It's a constant, very natural flow of discussion.
Yeah, it's never like there's a battle. Like, we don't sit in a big conference room and, like, you know, or, you know, and, like, say, okay, like, we totally want Dr. Cole. Like, he has to be with us. I think it also depends thematically, like, what a writer wants to do with a character. Because sometimes what you want to do in the DCU really just wouldn't interest the Vertigo readers. And then on the other side of the coin, sometimes a writer wants to do something that is more mature and doesn't really know how to work it into a DC story, so they might pitch something to Vertigo. So, you know, we sort of have like a professional courtesy between editors. And if there is a character that seems, you know, from the early days, might have been a Vertigo-type character, like the Golden Age Sandman, mm-hmm. you know, like possibly, you know, Shade the Changing Man, then we would definitely have a discussion about it. But I think, as you've probably noticed, Vertigo sort of moved more into the creator-own angle, and we do fewer of the DC character resurrections, so to speak, than we have in the early days of the line. But we're still open to it, especially if fans will support it. I think that's one of the reasons why The Young Men is coming out this year. Swamp Thing came to a close, and editor John Behnken just came up with a pitch that was really unique and interesting, so we thought it might be an interesting way to actually use a little bit of the old mythology, but come up with a new take on it that makes it very modern.
And just to circle back to the Grant metaphor, to give you another example, you know, the person who's been writing Zatanna the most recently has been Grant, but he's mostly been writing it in the DC Universe, although she's been in Vertigo in the past, and it's just that the particular material that he wants for her, I think, works better in the DC Universe right now, so it's a natural fit at this time. Down the road, that might change. So,
hi.
I'm wondering about creative control at Vertigo, in the sense that when people are coming up with new characters and new storyline ideas, do they have to adapt that to, let's say, a culture of the company? Or is it just a matter of the artist and the writer working together? Or is it a matter of market research? Like you said before, Vertigo fans may like this and may like more. So who actually gets the decision-making power?
I'm only looking at you because I'm hoping that I understood the question. Basically, he was asking who makes the creative decision as to how
well, what you do. When you're making a character, right?
Yes, thematically.
Let's say when you're making a character, someone will say, the our readers do not like this character, or this is something that Vertigo doesn't do.
Okay, well, I got it. Okay, so basically, he's saying, like, with a creator-owned book, who has the control to decide whether something is, like, appropriate for Vertigo or maybe not right? Well, the beauty of a creator-owned book is that a writer and an artist come to us with an idea. So there's no continuity involved. And so we probably wouldn't want to buy the property if it didn't fit into our parameters. But I say parameters loosely because what I love about Vertigo is we're always pushing boundaries. And I love the creators that come up to me and throw me something that at first read or at first listen totally doesn't sound like a Vertigo book. To me, that's exciting because I want to know what makes it cool, what makes it modern, what makes it pop art. So I think I'm answering your question. If somebody pitched us a book that featured a DC character, we would, as the company, it would be a work for hire book, so therefore we would have a little bit more say in maybe how much we'd want it to sort of guide it. But for a creator owned book, if we loved your project, we would just want to work with you to create something that was awesome and unique, but it wouldn't have to follow any particular standard or set of guidelines.
Yeah, I think that, you know, people sometimes have the misconception from afar that, oh, Vertigo will only do magic characters, Vertigo will only do Sandman characters, but if you look at the way things have evolved, especially in the last, you know, 5 to 8 years right now, for a while Sandman did define the line, but then new properties like Preacher came in, which was a completely different direction. And you've still got that sort of Preacher sensibility right now, kind of in titles like Scout, but now at the same time you've got this new wave that's Minx that has, you know, that doesn't relate to that particular wave at all, but is kind of leading the line right now. So, you know, they're always, it's sort of like pitches for the DCU. If, you know, it's sort of like saying, well, you only take Batman pitches, and, you know, they don't just do Batman, they do Batman, Superman, Vertigo has its
right
particular worlds that are all just sort of united by a much more general, mature, gritty, non-superhero sensibility.
I think that's what's really defined the line and what's made it so rich and so genre-specific. We went from being, the sort of the burger books, as they were called. Karen was known for taking the supernatural characters in the DC universe, like Hellblazer and Doom Patrol, and she sort of created her own environment, and that became Vertigo. So we were known in the early days as sort of dark fantasy and horror because those were the books that actually really kicked off the line, and of course Sandman. But I think as we've grown as an imprint, it's been exciting. I think crime fiction has really defined us a lot with 100 Bullets. You know, I know that's like, even though I don't edit a lot of that stuff, that's the stuff I read and I love, and I think that that's given us a nice gritty edge, as Jaron said. And I think the fantasy genre from Vertigo has also gone into some unique and interesting ways with Crossing Midnight, which fuses Asian horror and projects like Fables, which, you know, gives us a different side of the fantasy scope that's still compelling and interesting, but just, you know, creates diversity. Because I think our readers are so smart and they want fresh, exciting new things. You know, it's 21st century fiction, and I'd like to think that we do provide a really nice mix and hopefully something for every taste. Did I answer the question?
Definitely.
Thank you. Hi, your question.
Yeah, you have some great books out, but a lot of it is very kind of liberal. How much? Which book gets the most conservative hate mail?
Oh my goodness. Ooh, okay, the question is, which book receives the most conservative hate mail? You know, it's funny, years ago, you know, when people actually wrote in letters, I used to love opening them. I used to love writing letters pages. I mean, I was as passionate as the readers, and it was fun to work on letter columns. I would say we don't get hate mail per se. I mean, sometimes on the message boards, things can get pretty testy. I can't think of anything like off the top of my head. You know, even with something like American Virgin, which, you know, the subject matter of the book, you know, is pretty intense, we have not received, like, too many hardcore complaints.
Not even based on stuff like Feature, anything Dark Knight strikes?
I can't think of anything over the recent years. Maybe during its heyday. I didn't edit Preacher, so I really can't speak confidently about it. I would imagine so, but I can't think of anything in recent years. And maybe it's just like, you know, a comment on just society at large. You know, we are definitely living in different times now than when Preacher was, like, you know, really, like, super hot in the late 90s. And I wish I could make up an interesting story, like, off the cuff that would sound intriguing, but I can't think of anything. And I apologize, I can't think of anything that would really, you know, answer the question and honestly. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, go for it.
Since no one else has one, this is kind of unrelated, but what would you suggest to someone who's interested in?
Oh, that's like my favorite question. The question is, what would I say to someone who's interested in becoming an editor? And I can't thank you enough. That's the greatest question, because so many people think the editor's job is just like nothing. You know, we're so often forgotten once, you know, everybody's just celebrating the release of a title. And we're sort of like the behind-the-scenes people. And to me, it's the most exciting, creative job in the entire world. It's the greatest job nobody knows about. And the way that I got involved, I had a film degree and found comics through a screenwriting class and applied to a small independent company who hired me as an editorial assistant. And I answered phones, and I stuffed comp bags, and I swept floors, and I learned how to Xerox, which I thank Bob Schreck for that, because he taught me how to Xerox.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, I was an art snob. I was a film snob. I was, like, Xeroxing? But, okay, I had to start somewhere. And I learned trial by fire. I was really lucky. I was hired by Diana Schutz. And even though she left Kamiko, the comic company, 3 months after I was hired, I was told I could stay if I decided, if I agreed to be the editorial department. And I was 21, and I was like, yeah, I can do anything. I was a film major. And I was the editor of the books for 2 years, and I learned the hard way. And I'm grateful to the people who helped me back then. I learned a lot from writers and artists. And when the company went under, I worked in casting for a few years in film, but came back to comics and started again as an assistant editor, even though I was an editor before. I, like, bit the bullet because I was going to be working for Karen Berger, who was, like, doing cool things. And I worked my way up. I always tell people if they want to edit comics, you don't have to have an English degree. You don't have to have a journalism degree. I found my film background was very useful because I could really communicate with artists. Because even though I'm not technically an artist, I have a skill set in sequential storytelling, which has really helped me over the years. It helps bringing backgrounds like art history and foreign languages, and that's what I think makes each editor unique, because at the end of the day, the editor is a tastemaker. I am hired for my taste, and I like to say to people when it comes to my job, if you pick up a comic book, you love the cover, you think the logo is neat, you read it, you think the story is compelling, you think the art is fantastic, see my name in the credits. If you pick up a comic and the color is so bright it blinds you, the art is so wonky you can't tell a hand from a bunch of bananas, and the story leaves you cold, see my name in the credits. It's basically, you know, you're responsible, and there's nothing more exciting than getting that monthly periodical in your hands and saying, I put this together. I took it from a spark of an idea, and this is what it's become, and this is art.
Yeah, I think Shelley covered just about anything, but everything, but I'll just add really quickly that, while, like she said, it's not required to have a journalism or an English or a film degree, it is good for your basics to be very strong. I get a lot of resumes from people who say that they want to be a comic book editor because it's always been their dream to work at DC, and their enthusiasm is great, but that's not enough. There actually is a very large traditional editing component to this, in addition to being able to understand it, you know, being familiar with sequential storytelling. You know, it is actually important to have very good, strong, natural, or learned line editing, copy editing, and sort of journalistic organizational skills in order to begin. You can't have too much of that going in.
Oh, absolutely.
The basics are important.
Absolutely. No, it's a good point. I think I was lucky because I was mentored. You know, I learned from an art director in the early days of the independent company, and then of course I learned just by being in comics with some of the wonderful editors like Karen Berger and others at DC. But I think it's also important to know that editing is multitasking. You're doing 100 things at once. You have to be part art director, part copy editor, part psychiatrist for the artist who hides under the drawing table, like the one I married, who I don't work with anymore, whose life I edit, who I adore. There are people you need to motivate, and if they're really that talented, they're worth it. So you need to not only wear the hat that says, I'm a hardcore script editor, you also have to be able to encourage people and inspire people to get the best work out of them on every level, working internally at the office with our production department and with our marketing departments, and also just freelance, where we deal with people who live all over the world. So we really have to structure our days for different time zones, and it's a lot of juggling. It's also, someone at another panel made the comparison to being a director or a producer, and that's really what it is. You know, we are putting together all the elements to make sure that the end result is a fantastic, fantastic sequential story that will hopefully change your life, and it's exciting because of that.
Just to add on to that, if I may, sorry.
That's okay.
There do seem to be a couple other people, so I don't know. How much time do we have?
I think we have a couple more minutes.
Yeah. But
just the method I was thinking about going about it, I appreciate your input, honestly, because I don't have any degrees. Obviously, I need a way to make my skills visible. Like, I read a lot of comics. I read North American comics, Japanese comics, European comics, web comics, and I feel that I've developed a really great sense of taste that I wanted to keep my part. So I was thinking of starting like a review blog or something.
Okay.
And just getting that out there, maybe emailing my reviews to editors and so forth, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly couldn't hurt. Another thing to do is if you get a job as an editor at an independent company, or you get a job with a larger company in a different division. I mean, the editorial jobs are, like, really coveted, and they are absolutely difficult to get, without a doubt. But getting yourself an editing credit of some kind is a good way to get your foot in the door. But certainly, you know, I think staying active in comics and also just asking people for advice whenever you can, you know, it's certainly flattering. And I always tell people, whether you want to be an editor or a writer or an artist or a letterer, you know, it's very flattering just to have someone ask, how did you get involved? Can you give me some advice? This business is awesome. Everybody is so kind, and everyone has had their own bottom of the ladder, working your way up story. So don't be afraid to talk to creators at shows. Go up to tables. Get advice from everyone, because people definitely in this business, we like to stick together. We're still one of those industries that thankfully is still niche enough that we're cool and we're not selling out. So just feel free just to talk to people, and everyone will give you different input that might help you out with your career path. Yes?
The Fables, Jacket Fables crossover you mentioned, is that going to be like a single thread that bounces back and forth, or like two parallel threads that are kind of connected?
The answer is yes. The answer is you will find out. I'm not going to ruin the surprise. But there have been a couple of questions that people have had over the past year about how the two books connect, because from a time perspective, they're off by about a year. That will be resolved. And when you read the issues where they resolve it, a lot of some of the like little dangling threads from both books that you might have wondered about will totally be tied up. And you'll be like, oh my God, I totally didn't see that coming. Or, I knew that was coming.
When they're released in trade, will they still be separate books? Or
yes.
Will they be a combo book?
No, they won't need to be a combo book. They will be separate. But you'll be like, hey, I knew about that before the trade, which will be cool. Yeah. Last question.
Yes. When you're looking at new talent or a new project, is there a cutoff point for a lack of pre-existing work?
No, again, this one's again assumes we have a single standard, and we really don't. It can vary wildly. But you go ahead and expand on that question a little. You were about to.
Well, if someone who's an unknown in the industry doesn't have a pre-existing body of work comes to you with a project, is there a certain part of your head that goes, this person doesn't have an experience, you really just want to wait and see what they can offer?
Well, when people ask me a question similar to that, which is basically, if you don't have credits, can I still pitch to you? The answer is, very bluntly, it's very difficult for your first published work to be with a major company. It happens, absolutely. It happens once in a while, and once in a great while, I might add. I usually say to people who are interested in writing comics, get published. People think that's so crass, but it's the best advice I can give you. We're living in an age where it's so easy and so cheap to put your thoughts on paper, whether you even just do it as a webcomic or on MySpace, whether you do a mini comic that you Xerox. If you're a writer, go to an art school, put up a sign. I can guarantee you that there are young artists who would be thrilled to put your prose on paper. If you're an artist, you want a writer, go to a journalism school, go to a creative writing seminar. Find people, go online, go on blogs, find someone who you think might get your sensibility. As editors, we go to comic book stores, we look at mini comics. I discovered Raina Telgemeier a number of years ago with her Smile comic, because I like to support young cartoonists, so I definitely read them, I look at them. If you're not published, it's tough, because we really do like to see if you can tell a story, whether you write or draw. But that said, I have opened the odd submission. There was one in 16 years. And in fact, he's a Toronto, our Canadian artist, and he was the illustrator of Barnum. A number of years ago, we put the book out. He also illustrated Pride. His name is Miko Anrishan. And the true story about how he got his first job in comics was that he sent me an envelope. He had just graduated art school. I was working with Howard Chaykin on Barnum. We were looking for an artist. I had three people set aside, and I opened up the envelope, and I went, oh my God, this guy's so good. And I showed it to Howard. He's like, yep, it's him. He's hired. Let's get him. And when I called him, he thought I was playing a joke on him. Thought I was kidding. That's once in 16 years. That shows you it happens, but it doesn't happen often. So I would say really try to get yourself published and start from there. And then when you get a body of work, I think that will be impressive to see, to see that you have the patience and the perseverance and that you're really serious.
Yeah, I mean, the Thunderbolt stories really are few and far between, but they do happen. Willow Wilson is another example. I believe she had done a little bit of work for Boom Studio, which Keith does work for on the side, but I hadn't even seen that. Keith had seen it and just recommended, you know, she had handed him this sort of sample chapter for what she proposes, a 12-issue maxi series. He liked it so much he brought the chapter to me. I didn't even see her Boom Studio work. It just knocked me out. And I sent it to Karen. And again, you know, I didn't see the Boom Studio stuff, but Keith did. Again, she had it out there. Gail right. Simone is another example. If I remember correctly, you know, she started out writing a review column for Comic Book Resources called You'll All Be Sorry, and I believe got work at Bongo Comics on the strength of that, and then just, you know, continued on an arc from there through Marvel and DC. So it is just a matter of figuring out what your strengths are, you know, publishing or getting your words out there on even a small scale in the areas where you're strongest, and letting your work speak for itself.
And I think I'm a story like that too, because I wrote novels, and then they were looking for Minx, they were looking for young adult, you know, sort of sensibilities, and because I had two novels under my belt. You know, they asked if I was interested.
And they would be me, by
yeah,
the way.
They
would be moi. Thank you very much. Yeah, actually.
Thank you very much.
No. Thank you very much. Anyway, I think they're going to kick us out, but I wanted to thank you all so much for being a great audience and for supporting the Vertigo line. So proud to have been a part of it since its inception in 1993. And thank you so much for your enthusiasm and your support.